Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present investigative journalist and author Greg Palast, who explains why he believes the Republican Party fought so hard to stop the Green Party-initiated vote recounts in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Former health insurance executive Wendell Potter, who discusses the health insurance chaos and political fallout that will likely result from the Trump and Republican Party pledge to repeal Obamacare. And Marty Hayden of the group Earth Justice, who talks about the coal mining stream protection rule recently issued by the outgoing Obama administration and the Trump GOP threat to overturn it. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After months of controversy, Saudi Arabia has admitted using UK-manufactured cluster bombs in Yemen against Houthi rebels, who are backed by Iran. The Saudi admission has raised questions about British control of cluster munitions that were sold to the Saudi kingdom in the late 1980s. Britain ratified the 2010 International Cluster Munitions Convention that bans the use of deadly and indiscriminate cluster munitions. Amnesty International first exposed the Saudi use of cluster bombs in Yemen a year ago. More recently, British TV networks ITV and Sky News confirmed those reports. In November, Britain's Tory government began a full-scale inquiry into the Saudi military's use of cluster bombs in Yemen. As a result, the Obama administration has pulled back from planned arms sales to the Saudi kingdom that included airdrop munitions and high-tech precision-guided bombs. Yemen's 20-month-old civil war has killed over 10,000 civilians and triggered a full-scale humanitarian crisis. Amazon, the giant online retailer, is increasing its market share with promises of free delivery and new services for its lucrative Amazon Prime customers. At the same time, Amazon has, since the Great Recession, won over $600 million in subsidies from taxpayers to help finance its new network of warehouses. Over the last 5 years, Amazon has transformed itself by offering new services to high-end consumers. The company has largely abandoned its earlier business model of locating its warehouses in low-tax states and avoiding paying sales taxes. But now, Amazon is building up its infrastructure in the Northeast and Midwest to tap affluent customers. Over the last year, Amazon has won $240 million in tax concessions in Connecticut, Florida, Minnesota, Texas, and Massachusetts. The local tax breaks come as Amazon has grown into the eighth largest retailer, by sales, in the nation. Amazon is using its enormous economy of scale and its ability to lower prices to drive out smaller competitors. Just before Christmas, Ohio Governor John Kasich signed a bill that blocks a scheduled referendum on a higher minimum wage in Cleveland. The planned May 2017 vote, organized by labor advocates, would have eventually raised the minimum wage to $15 an hour. 35,000 Cleveland residents work full-time, making less than $15 an hour, and half of those working poor are African Americans. The legislation signed by Kasich caps the state minimum wage at $8.10 an hour and bars any municipality from authorizing a higher wage. According to Think Progress, 20 states have preempted higher local minimum wage laws. Moreover, 15 states have also blocked local paid leave laws. But despite this conservative campaign, 21 minimum wage increases were approved across the country in 2016. Wisconsin's Republican governor, Scott Walker, initiated the wave of conservative preemption when he signed a law in 2011, blocking cities from passing laws requiring paid sick leave time, which overturned sick leave benefits in Milwaukee. Preemption strategies were quickly adopted by the right-wing organizations such as the National Restaurant Association and the Koch brothers-financed American Legislative Exchange Council. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
With Donald Trump's presidential election victory defying most pollsters' forecasts, Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein's pursuit of a vote recount in the historically Democratic states of Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania were welcomed by many in a nation suffering from political shock. Of the three states, Wisconsin was the only one to complete a recount, financed by small donors across the U.S. who contributed to a fund set up by Stein. However, Republican legal objections succeeded in blocking the completion of a vote recount in Michigan and prevented a vote recount in Pennsylvania from ever getting started. Although the recount in Wisconsin didn't change the state's results, Stein said the process she initiated revealed deep flaws in state systems for administering voting and verifying results. She cited election irregularities in Michigan, including more than 75,000 uncounted ballots, as evidence of the need to re-examine that state's election outcome and the urgency for reform of state laws that make verification of voting results more difficult. Greg Palast is an investigative reporter and award-winning author who uncovered the Republican voter purge in Florida that led to what many charge was a stolen election in 2000 that put George W. Bush in the White House. In his new documentary film titled The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, A Tale of Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, Palast investigates a multi-state system known as CrossCheck that he says was employed to wrongly purge some 1.1 million Americans of color from the voter rolls of GOP-controlled states. Your reporter spoke with Palast, who reports on the results of his most recent investigation into the Green Party-initiated recounts in the three Rust Belt states and the Republican Party effort to stop them.
I think that the recount was sabotaged in Wisconsin, sabotaged and stopped in Michigan, halted in Pennsylvania, because they knew what would happen if you actually counted all the votes. And this is the dark secret of American democracy. These, we don't count all the votes. There are officially, this is not, you know, Greg Palast finger in the wind type stuff. We have an agency called the Elections Assistance Commission, which tracks the number of votes and the number of no votes, the number of ballots which are never counted. They call it spoiled. And the problem is that if you're black, the chance your vote will spoil for a technical reason is 900% higher than if you're white. And we saw that happen in Michigan, in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Ohio, North Carolina, Arizona, and Florida. That's quite a bit. All of those Trump so-called victories, margins there, may not be victories if you pulled ballots out of the electoral dumpster and counted them. We don't count all the ballots in America. And no nation can count all ballots. There's always some that are spoiled and legitimately destroyed and unreadable. But in America, it's in the millions, and it is deliberately biased against voters of color. That is our nasty secret. Jill Stein told me that she, when I met up with her in Detroit, she said she expected to find Russian hackers and stuff like that that may have bent the vote. And she said, what I found instead, and this is a quote from her, what I found instead was a Jim Crow election, black votes uncounted that made the difference. So that's why they had to stop her from counting those votes.
Greg, how typical is it that you'd have 75,000 plus votes in Flint and Detroit, as you described, that went uncounted? If you go back to presidential election years like 2012, 2008, and so on.
Just in Florida, 2000, 181,000 ballots were rejected as uncountable for hanging chads and similar reasons. 181,000 ballots. So 75,000 ballots in Michigan, that's not unusual. And where are those ballots not counted? Generally, they're not counted in black areas, as the U.S. Civil Rights Commission found in both its nationwide and state studies. Why in Detroit? Well, remember, and Flint. Remember, Detroit and Flint are bankrupt cities. They were taken over by the Republican governor, who appointed what he called emergency managers, who then slashed the budgets of these cities. First, they slashed the budget for the water supply of Flint. And infamously, they poisoned the children of Flint. When you're talking about people to save a few bucks who have no problem poisoning children, the idea that they would poison the election machinery is nothing. What they did was something simple. The black officials begged the state to let them spend the money to get new voting machines because their old voting machines, their ancient voting machines, just didn't work. They were broken. And in fact, on Election Day, 87 machines broke down in Detroit. 87. Each of those machines is supposed to tabulate thousands of votes. What happened to those votes?
What are the dangers you see in the Trump administration as it takes power with its chosen Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, with a horrendous record of racist statements and prejudicial actions as a senator, and the appointment of a Supreme Court justice or justices that may fall to Trump, as well as federal judges that he'll have, from what I heard, an estimated 100 of who he'll get to choose?
Yeah, two things immediately. Number one, Jeff Sessions says we're going to eliminate the Voting Rights Act. Trump could not have been elected if it wasn't for the gutting of the Voting Rights Act in 2013, but it's still hanging in there, the Voting Rights Act. That is going to be removed utterly. And if they can't remove it utterly, though I think that they will, they simply won't enforce it. Because right now, you've got the mob, you've got the vote heist mafia, is running the FBI, literally, is running the enforcement division of the Civil Rights Enforcement Division, Voting Rights Enforcement Division of the Justice Department, which will now become an injustice department. It's true that Obama basically was frozen in place, and his Justice Department was pretty much useless throughout his 8 years. You know, one thing is the jalopy not moving. The other thing is for it to race in reverse at high speed. We're going to be back in 1955 when it comes to voting. I'm telling you that right now. We're going to be coming back to that same situation where we're going to be for black people, and now the new black people known as students and Asian Americans are going to have a heck of a time trying to vote. Students, Asian Americans, African Americans, Latinos, look out in those GOP-controlled states. We're going back to the 50s.
That was investigative reporter and author Greg Palast, whose new documentary film is titled The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, A Tale of Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. Find links to Palast's investigations and related election analysis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Ever since the passage of the Affordable Care Act in 2010, known widely as Obamacare, the Republican Party has staged continuous rhetorical attacks on the health care law and held more than 60 votes to repeal the legislation. Now, with the election of Donald Trump to the White House and Republicans maintaining control of both the House and Senate, the party will be in position to destroy the legislation that, for all its flaws, has brought health insurance to more than 20 million Americans, many of them for the first time. The Affordable Care Act has reduced the number of uninsured Americans, although some 30 million still don't have coverage. ACA provisions include Medicaid expansion, health insurance marketplace coverage, and changes in private insurance that allows young adults to stay on their parents' health insurance plans and requires insurance plans to cover people with pre-existing health conditions. While Republicans are eager to repeal Obamacare and promise to replace it, the GOP has no viable public proposals to do so. Trump says he would permit health insurance companies to sell policies across state lines, encourage more people to enroll in health savings accounts, and give states almost total control over Medicaid through block grants. But none of these ideas will make up for the loss of subsidies for working families that would be lost under the ACA, and the rise of health care costs will continue unchecked. Your reporter spoke with Wendell Potter, a former health insurance industry executive and best-selling author, who discusses the health insurance market chaos and political fallout that he says will likely result if Trump and the Republicans carry out their pledge to repeal Obamacare.
They feel that it's important for them to pass something because they've led their voters to think that Obamacare is the worst thing ever and that they are going to repeal it and replace it with who knows what. It will not be as easy as they think. And one of the things I found during my time on Capitol Hill during the debate on Obamacare was that lawmakers have a very shallow understanding of how the health insurance marketplace really works. And I'm sure that they're getting a crash course right now from my former colleagues in the health insurance business, and they're undoubtedly coming to realize that undoing Obamacare in ways that they have said they plan to do it can really create enormous chaos and frankly a meltdown of the individual healthcare marketplace, which I think they very well could do.
Two of the features of Obamacare, or the ACA, that people generally like is the fact that young people 26 years of age and younger can remain on their parents' health insurance plans, and also the important fact that insurance companies now cannot deny people for pre-existing conditions, can't deny
right.
them insurance. And we hear that the individual mandate, that's a big part of the Obamacare program, the idea that you have to buy some kind of insurance or you're going to get hit with a tax penalty, is the mechanism by which these two features that people like remain in place. Donald Trump is on record saying he likes these two features as well. How can Obamacare's individual mandate be repealed and these benefits that people enjoy remain in place?
You really can't do that, and I'm sure that's what the lobbyists for the industry are telling him and the transition team and Republicans in Congress. And I think the leadership of the Republican Party in the House and the Senate probably understand that, but the rank and file is probably news to them that can't be done. And the problem is, when the Affordable Care Act was being debated, the insurance industry said, okay, sure, we will go along with doing away with pre-existing conditions so long as you include an enforceable individual mandate, a purchase to buy coverage. And the Obama administration and Congress went along with that. When he was campaigning for the presidency the first time, Obama was against the individual mandate. But he quickly came to realize after he was elected that you can't do away with pre-existing condition exclusions and without having an individual mandate. The market just will not work. And there's evidence of that in several states that have tried it in the past. Washington State, New York State, and Kentucky are three that come to mind, that all three tried to do this. They tried to force the insurance industry to accept all applicants, and they couldn't reject anyone, but they didn't have the individual mandate. And that created the dreaded death spiral in every one of those states. Insurance companies began to leave the states, and premiums went sky high, and only the wealthiest and the sickest, quite frankly, who had money, were able to buy coverage.
Wendell, I've read some studies about the folks in the country that are benefiting from the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, and it turns out that some 80% of those benefiting are in the same demographic of white working class voters who went overwhelmingly to vote for Donald Trump. What's the potential for political fallout here if Trump and Congress follow through on this pledge to get rid of Obamacare without any real viable replacement for it?
Well, there's enormous risk to the party, and I wrote a piece for Bill Moyer's website earlier this month, and I said that as they're coming to terms with what they might unleash if they do indeed pass a repeal bill without any thoughtful replacement, it can and probably will create a lot of uncertainty and chaos. And insurance companies don't like uncertainty. They don't like, believe it or not, they don't like risk. And so they will start fleeing the marketplace. And that will mean that a lot of people who voted for Trump and Republicans will begin to get notices ultimately that their coverage is being canceled. Now, I'm sure some of the busiest people in Washington right now are Republican PR people. They undoubtedly are creating PR strategies for various scenarios of what will happen if Congress does this or that. And the worst case scenario is that the market does melt down and people are not able to get the coverage that they've had. There was, as you may remember, the Republicans made a huge deal out of the fact that some people had to change their policies after Obamacare was passed. We're talking about, relatively few people compared to the people, the over 20-some million who would be in that predicament if they go forward with a bill to repeal Obamacare. And they've been saying that they don't think it's it's all that necessary to pass a replacement bill at the same time. That's not something that will work. I think the reason they're saying that is that they don't have a plan. They don't know what to do. They've talked over the past few years about a few, you know, they brought out a few things that make for good talking points, but they just simply, they don't constitute good health policy, and they will not work in terms of actually replacing the Affordable Care Act and providing people with affordable coverage.
That was Wendell Potter, a former health insurance industry executive and best-selling author of Deadly Spin and Nation on the Take. Find links to Potter's articles in his new investigative online journal, Tarbell, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In the waning days of the Obama administration, an environmental regulation that was years in the making was finalized in December. The Stream Protection Rule, which will take effect on January 19, 2017, was designed to protect streams and other bodies of water in Appalachia from pollution and even obliteration by mountaintop removal coal operations. The new measure is an improvement over a previous regulation implemented during the George W. Bush era, but according to some environmentalists, it does not go far enough. To make matters worse, the incoming Trump administration and the Republican-controlled Congress have the power to repeal it because it was promulgated so late in Obama's tenure, which is something Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has already promised to do. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Marty Hayden, Vice President for Policy and Legislation with the group Earth Justice, which has represented opponents of mountaintop removal coal mining, who have campaigned to safeguard air and water quality. Here, Hayden explains what the Stream Protection Rule does and doesn't do, and what's likely to happen to the measure when Donald Trump takes office.
In 1977, Congress passed the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act. That's the law that regulates coal mining. Part of that law prohibited coal mines from causing material damage to surface waters and groundwater. In 1983, the Reagan administration created the Stream Buffer Zone Rule, which prohibited mining within 100 feet of streams. Now, the problem with that is that was essentially never really enforced by the states. In 2008, President George W. Bush did his own rule to replace the Reagan rule, and his rule literally just said that they should minimize direct disturbance to the extent deemed reasonable to streams, which for all practical purposes was so vague to be unenforceable. Now, we and other groups sued that rule, and federal court threw it out in 2014. That is what led the Obama administration to put out the rule that just came out. Now, compared to the Bush rule, this is better, but it could have been much better. It's actually a modest step forward. The positive things it does is require improved baseline monitoring and data collection, both from the chemical side and the biological side of what the impacts of mountaintop removal coal mining are in the region, and hence would allow communities access to information about what is in their water, which they don't have today. The other improvement that it has is a requirement that the companies have to rebuild the streams and restore the stream function. That's primarily through having enough of a financial bonding requirement that they can afford to do that. The Obama administration kind of left a lot of things on the table in this role as well. Kind of most notable, I think, is while it still has what's called a stream buffer zone, it's really a buffer in name only, because it allows the industry is still going to be allowed to do valley fills within the buffer. Instead of having the Office of Surface Mining over at Interior impose clear requirements to protect the streams from mining, it leaves it to the states to fill in the blanks. which we know most of the mountaintop states aren't likely to be very vigorous about that.
So the new regulation is far from perfect, but better than what came before. But Marty Hayden, isn't it true that Congress can undo regulations finalized within a certain number of days of the end of a president's term, and this one falls within that time period?
Yes. It is called the Congressional Review Act. It allows Congress to pass a resolution of disapproval and veto, in this case, a rule. And if the president signs that veto, then the rule is gone. At the beginning of a new Congress, it's anything that had not been published and transmitted to Congress within 60 days, 60 legislative days of the end of the session, which this rule, obviously, having just come out in December, would be. Mitch McConnell has already said he intends to do that.
In the end, whether this rule is repealed or not, how much difference will it make?
This rule, and plus, more importantly, I think the ability to revisit this rule, you know, in a future administration to strengthen it is very important. Mountaintop removal, it's not just that we're blowing up the mountains and causing deforestation and burying headwater streams. We're hurting people. They are, you know, a tremendous source of toxic pollution, both in water and air, that is hurting the people in the communities that surround these facilities. There have been numerous scientific studies over the last 6 years that it's a growing body of evidence that connects mountaintop removal with elevated rates of cancer, kidney disease, birth defects, cardiovascular and pulmonary disease, and other health problems. This is real. So controlling the pollution that's allowed to leave these sites at the end of the day is really important. And while this rule may not go far enough, we sure wouldn't want to lose the ability to do a strong rule in the future.
That was Marty Hayden, Vice President for Policy and Legislation, with the group Earth Justice. Learn more about Earth Justice and groups engaged in the campaign to stop mountaintop removal coal mining by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.